The Tom Woods Show, episode 831.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
To all my young listeners, you want to stand out from your peers? Then don't do what they do. Join Praxis, get real on-the-job experience, and a real job. Be entrepreneurial. Get all the details at tomwoods.com/praxis. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Jay Richards comes back to the show after a long absence, and I'm very glad to be talking to Jay about his book, Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. He reviews a lot of myths about capitalism. You're likely to hear these myths repeated day in and day out by the news media as they interpret the events of the next 4 years. So it's useful to be on your guard and ready. And this is a useful, helpful book to do so. And it makes a particular appeal to Christians who are not always fully on board with the market economy. And he explains why they ought to be. Incidentally, I don't say this as a, you know, as picking on Christians or, you know, to single them out. Obviously, most people in our society don't fully understand economics. Even the economists half the time don't really understand what's going on. So it seems petty to pick on them. So I'm not actually picking on them. I'm saying that I'd like to talk to them. I'd like to reach them and reason with them. I've had some of the same struggles that Jay has had, so I know we're going to have a good conversation. Jay is an assistant research professor in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America, and he is executive editor of The Stream, which you can visit at stream.org. Jay, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. So good to be with you again.
You've had some interesting career change since we last talked, and you've been doing all sorts of other stuff, but yet I still want to talk about a book of yours from 2009. It's evergreen,
yes,
and I really like it, and I'm sorry I kind of overlooked it for a while, and so I'm going to rectify that injustice right now. So it's called Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. I never really got what it was. I never realized how much I needed this book until I started reading. I feel that way about a lot of my books, by the way. People,
right.
If only you'd start reading them, you'd know how much you want to read them.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you tell me what it was that made you say, especially given that you've written on completely different topics in the past,
right,
I've got to drop everything and write a book on this, or I'm going to lose my mind? Because that, by the way, that's the reason I write most of my books. If I don't get this on paper, I'm going to lose my mind.
That is, Tom, that is the perfect summary of what got me into this. I was working at the Discovery Institute, writing mainly on science and faith issues, was also doing some stuff with Acton, and was talking about, you know, the evidence for fine-tuning in physics, but I was on a lot of Christian college campuses and realized, okay, all the really bad ideas I had about economics in 1985 and 86 were alive and well in the late 90s and in the 2000s. I had grown up, gone to a small, very liberal arts school in Texas as an undergrad, read the Communist Manifesto, you know, sort of transfixed by it as freshmen often are, and thought that Christians ought to be socialist. And it took me 4 years of college and a lot of reading by, you know, people like Thomas Sowell and Friedrich Hayek to realize, no, of the live alternatives, free enterprise, economic freedom, that's by far the best that we can do. But I graduated from college in 1989, the Soviet Union collapsed, and I thought, well, okay, the big argument between communism and capitalism, or between command and free economies, has been settled by the verdict of history. So I won't focus on that as an intellectual question. Ended up doing a PhD in philosophy, but that put me back on college campuses, even though I was writing on other stuff, and I realized that socialism is a perennial issue, I think, because it appeals to people's untutored moral intuitions. It sounds nice to people as an aspiration, as long as you don't look at it in too much detail. And frankly, I was just distressed that conservative evangelicals at conservative evangelical colleges were still toying with this what should be a completely dead idea that does terrible things whenever it's tried. And so that's honestly what got me focused on it. But I thought there's so many good books written by people like you and others on free enterprise. I thought what I want to do is write a book that addresses what I thought were the key issues people had. I think just, you know, speaking of Christians, Christians usually are, if they're well tutored, if they have a properly formed conscience, their moral intuitions are right. But they're very often, what they do is they wed their moral intuitions to an utterly flawed understanding of economic reality. And it's usually as a result of some or another intellectual myth, like the zero-sum game myth, or what I call the materialist myth, which just assumes that wealth can only be transferred and not created. And so if you assume that, if Peter is richer than Paul, the only way he could be richer is if he'd stolen from Paul. If you believe that, then you're going to see inequality, for instance, differently than if you understand how the economic realm actually works. And so I wrote the book structured around these eight myths that I identified. And so each chapter focuses on one of the myths. And I thought, okay, if we can dismantle this, dignify the moral intuitions, dismantle the misconceptions about economics and replace it with something better, I thought that might be a productive way to help Christians think about these issues.
You know, you mentioned the one thing in the book that I might have changed slightly is you refer to that book by Ronald Sider, mm-hmm. Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger.
Yes.
But I'm not sure you referred to the brilliant reply, David Chilton's book, Productive Christians in an Age of Guilt Manipulators. That is
That's right.
Probably the best book title I have ever heard.
It is, and I've read that book, actually, and I just decided, I think I read it when I was working on Money, Greed, and God, and if I recall correctly, it was so grouchy that I thought maybe it wasn't the best way to go.
Yeah, I mean, with a title like that, obviously it is grouchy, but that title just kills me. All right, yeah, let's get, you know, of course, it's interesting for the two of us to talk because we've both written books that are in this sort of genre. I took a different path from you. I was sort of arguing, here's why Austrian economics is a good way to look at the world.
Yeah.
And I was reaching out and speaking to really the whole world. I mean, you can read The Church and the Market as an intermediate step between economics in one lesson and human action. But I had in mind a particular audience. It was traditionalist Catholics, not left-wing Catholics. I can't reach those people.
Right.
But traditionalists who kind of felt like, well, this newfangled free market of yours, as you so-called, it comes out of the Enlightenment, and we know that's bad. And,
right.
and it was very frustrating because none of them had read any of the relevant stuff, so I couldn't even have an argument. And meanwhile, I'm being excommunicated. That was the most bizarre thing I've ever gone through. So I wrote that book with them in mind. Your audience here, now are you, mm-hmm. I mean, if you mention Ronald Sider, then you're talking to the left, but at the same time, I feel certain that there are people in more mainstream and even conservative evangelical communities who have absorbed some of these, I think, faulty ways of thinking. So who's your audience here?
The audience here was essentially all Christians. What's funny, you may not know this, Tom, I was an evangelical when I started this book and a Catholic by the time it was published. We're adult converts. And so being at Acton, I was conversant with a lot of evangelical and Catholic thinkers. I really wanted to reach every Christian that's interested in the question of economics and poverty, but doesn't know very much about economics. And so I wanted to write it in such a way that it wasn't obvious. It was a very broadly Christian. I didn't want it to be pigeonholed as an evangelical or a Catholic book, but I'm definitely thinking of not the leftist, but of Christians in general that get influenced by left-wing things. I mean, I noticed Sider, I cited. I also talked a lot about Jim Wallis, who's a progressive evangelical, but he's read by evangelicals. He's read at evangelical, conservative evangelical seminaries and colleges. And so, you know, a lot of people don't realize that. They think I'll send my children to Calvin College or to Wheaton, you know, or someplace, and they'll be fine. They don't realize, actually, if you talk to the faculty, a lot of them are leftists, at least on economics. They may be orthodox theologically, but definitely not when it comes to politics and economics. So that's a huge market. And what I discovered is that a lot of Christian colleges and econ professors who are frustrated about this have ended up using the book alongside, the Principles of Economics textbook in intro econ courses, which is kind of what I wanted. I thought, okay, this is not most kids. It's not that, well, they've had several economics courses and didn't understand how supply and demand works. They don't understand anything about it. And so they're just led astray by the misconceptions. And so that's who I wanted to reach. I think, you know, at least initially the book is used largely in evangelical colleges in terms of actually being in the curriculum, though I know a few Catholic colleges, including my own, that use it in different classes, which is honestly, that's the greatest hope I could have had for the book.
All right, let's get into some of the specifics in here. You, in eight chapters, are dealing with eight different misconceptions. Let's pick the one you think is the overwhelmingly overriding one.
And it's definitely the piety myth. I mean, if you could, in fact, reduce it to that one. The piety myth is just confusing good intentions with with consequences, with outcomes. And of course, Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, the whole book is about that. You know, the art of economics consists, he says, in tracing not the consequences of a policy, not merely for one group, but for all groups. That it's confusing what we intend to do, what our aspirations are, with the actual effects of a policy or an action. And to prevent confusing that, you've got to learn something about this realm. And I describe, just as God has created, think of the created order as a set of concentric spheres that overlap and intersect, and they have their own internal logic. And so you can study chemistry, you can study physics, you can learn rules that can be discerned by studying this realm. And it's the result of an interaction of theories and observations. You can hopefully get closer and closer to the truth. I say, think of the economic realm as something like that. It's the realm of human existence in which humans buy and sell and exchange goods and services and information, often in a context of scarcity. And by studying that, first by analyzing it, as you've done in many of your books, analyzing what human action is like and understanding incentives, and also just looking at the empirical details, you can discover principles and laws that hold. It's not exactly the same as physics, but you can use them to predict what's going to happen when gasoline becomes scarce in Florida. And those are things you learn. They're empirical and theoretical questions. And so I say all Christians that want to think clearly about economic policy and economic issues, we need to take on board the theoretical insights and the empirical discoveries from economics. And if we don't do that, it's just as if we decided we're going to be a good Christian plane builder, but we're not going to bother to learn anything about lift or gravity or aerodynamics or Bernoulli's principle. You got to know the realities of the thing that you want to talk about if you want to talk about it reasonably. And that's honestly, it's that confusion between good intentions and sound outcomes that I think that's at the base of all the problems. And so sometimes I'm often asked to give talks on this question. I call it the piety myth because piety has to do with the state of our hearts. And as Christians, we know God cares both why we do something and what we do. Both of those things matter in the realm of morality. Both of those things don't matter when it comes to economics. It's what we do that matters. And the what isn't affected by whatever our motivations are. And so we don't want to focus on our piety, on the sort of warm feelings we have in our hearts. We want to focus on the real, likely or known consequences of economic actions if we actually want to help people rather than hurt them.
Just the other day, I got an email from somebody who said, I used to be a libertarian, and then I found Christ. And I now believe that you, Tom Woods, are teaching something at odds with what Christ teaches. He clearly is opposed to capitalism, as you're describing it. Mm-hmm. And I believe you, Tom Woods, wittingly or not, are part of a dark conspiracy going back hundreds of years, like at least back through the Illuminati. Like, it was the whole thing.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
The whole thing. He had gone from libertarianism to the craziest, nuttiest, weirdest possible version of Christianity that has ever existed. And then he demanded that I, explain and justify myself. And I, this is why the delete key exists on the computer. That's why there's a delete key. But let's give credit where it's due. He raises a legitimate question for discussion, which is we look through the biblical text and what do we see? We see a lot of verses about the rich and the poor.
Yes.
But what do we see about the welfare state or about antitrust law or about business cycles? I ask rhetorically.
Right. Yeah. Or any of these things or environmental regulations. I mean, even the, sort of locus classicus for the Christian who thinks that Christianity is communism is, the early chapters of Acts where the church in Jerusalem sells their possessions and shares everything in common. And people look at that and say, well, that's communism. The problem is, just look at the details. I mean, first of all, the Roman centurions aren't confiscating the means of production. This is a small group of Christians voluntarily sharing their goods and sharing amongst themselves. In fact, when Peter comes in and judges Ananias and Sapphira, he quite explicitly says, these are the people that claim to have sold their stuff and given it to the church, but in fact, they had held it back. He didn't say, well, you know, the stuff didn't belong to you. He said, in fact, it did belong to you, but what you did is you lied to the Holy Spirit. And so people, when you're looking at this, if you look at biblical texts superficially and impose economic misconceptions on it, you see something that's not there. This wasn't an early form of communism. First of all, we're dealing with a unique situation in Jerusalem. Pentecost has just happened. You have thousands of Jews that have come from around the civilized world, descended upon Jerusalem, and then suddenly become Christians. And so you have local Christians saying, well, what do we do with these new brothers and sisters? So it's an emergency situation in which they decide to sell some stuff in order to provide for their new Christian brothers and sisters. This was never treated as a norm. Paul doesn't tell the church at Thessalonica or Corinth to arrange things in this way. And in fact, it's likely that many of those new Christians eventually return to their homes and their jobs. And so all of this is right there in the text if you look at it. But if you think, oh, I see sharing, they're sharing stuff in common, that's communism. If you think at that level of generality, you're never going to quite understand what's going on in biblical text. Now, I would never say, okay, if you read the Bible, you're going to automatically be a free marketer. It's not that simple. I think as Christians, what we want to do is we want to draw on everything from special revelation, everything that we know as Christians, but we also want to learn things about the economic realm, which just simply aren't addressed directly in Scripture. That's no more crazy than saying, look, if you're a good Christian chemist, you don't expect to get the periodic table of the elements from the Bible. The Bible's going to give you information and knowledge. It's not going to give you everything you need to know to be a chemist.
And the thing I've had to deal with, of course, with the Catholic angle in particular, is people will wave this or that document from the U.S. bishops or something at me, and they'll say, well, what about this? And I'll say, well, there's a difference between proposing moral principles to be observed and proposing the technical means to best try to advance those. So, for example, you might say our moral ideal is a society where the family is supported.
Yes.
Okay, well, sure, family is very important. But then to say, now, we've also gone and looked into what the best way of going about this is, and we think a living wage for a head of household is the way to do it. Now you're way, way, way away from faith and morals. Now you're just talking about that. It would be the same thing as if a bishop said, you know, our churches should last hundreds of years as a testimony to the timelessness of God. Great. Wonderful to say that. But then if he says, now, the way to do that is you need the following building materials and this technique, we would think, okay, I guess he can have an opinion if he wants, but it's not very informed, and I certainly don't have to listen to it in that respect. Right. You know, try to be respectful. But you see what I mean? So it's the same sort of thing. If he wants to say, here's a general principle, fine with a general principle. But the specific implementation of it requires knowledge of a secular discipline just as much as architecture would.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it bears directly on human well-being. That's what got me interested in this. These are not sort of abstract questions. If you support a policy and actually give it theological imprimatur and it harms people, you're not only harming people, you're also bringing disgrace and disfavor upon the faith itself. And it is frustrating. I know as a Catholic, I'm very interested in the principles of Catholic social teaching. I think they have a great deal to do in sort of insights into the human condition and can be used to develop a kind of full-orbed understanding of the political economy. But unfortunately, churchmen and bishops and popes often don't know when their analysis of the faith and morals ends and their assumptions about economic reality begins. And so, you know, this frustrates me in some papal encyclicals. It's not like you get, okay, here's the section on the faith and morals, and then here's where the Pope gives his considered opinions on these things based upon his understanding of technology and economics. It's not that way. Most church documents, they mix these things together. So even Pope Francis's recent encyclical Laudato Si, even though in the encyclical it says, now the church doesn't specify and prescribe certain economic theories. Nevertheless, the Pope all very frequently in the same encyclical has all sorts of economic and scientific opinions. And so it's left to us to sort of to separate the chaff from the wheat, or to say, okay, what is core magisterial teaching here, and what is a Pope or a Pope's advisor's opinion on these things. And it's tough. And we've got to make clear that making those distinctions is not the same as sort of picking and choosing fundamental Catholic teachings and deciding we're going to take some and not take others. And that's not what's happening here. What's happening is that we have to distinguish between prudential and empirical questions on the one hand and core faith and morals questions on the other.
I have to keep this person as anonymous as possible. So let me just say he's a theologian who had a hand in drafting an encyclical by a certain living pope who is not actually reigning as pope right now,
yes.
If that helps narrow it down. And he contacted me to tell me he thought my book was excellent. So I take that as, okay, I am not breaking any rule by believing what I believe. It ain't no problem. All right, we've got a lot more myths to address. Let's first thank our sponsor. If you're an entrepreneurial young person who'd rather get job experience than sit through gender studies, then Praxis may be for you. At the end of your apprenticeship, you're guaranteed a job earning at least $40,000 a year, and the average Praxis graduate earns $55,000 a year out of the program. I recently sat down with Praxis alum Diana Zitting. Diana, tell me what your Praxis experience was like.
I had weekly meetings with my advisor. We chatted about my goals, things I wanted to learn in projects, and we came up with outlined details on how to make it happen. It was very personalized. The whole team knew me by name before I even started, so it was amazing.
Diana, what I think people may not realize is you're only 18 years old. You've already finished the program, and what are you doing now?
Yeah, so I am 4 years ahead of my peers who just completed a semester of college, and I'm working as sales manager at the company that I apprenticed with while I was in Praxis. I've got tangible, measurable proof that hiring me is an investment that pays off. I know how to stick out from other applicants for positions, and I truly feel like I know how to live a freer life. On top of that, I don't have a penny of debt.
Get all the details plus some bonus goodies when you check it out through tomwoods.com/praxis. All right, let's get back to this by looking at a question that I have faced quite a bit as somebody who is right of center and deals with people who are right of center. And their complaint is not that capitalism oppresses me in this way or that way. It's things more like capitalism gives us this ugly, debased culture that we have and this consumerist kind of culture where we're just addicted to material things.
Right. That's sort of toward the end of the book, and it is honestly because it's usually traditionalists that make this objection. It's not, and you will get leftists, people like Jim Wallis, that will kind of use this argument. It's essentially that capitalism or the free economy debases us morally and culturally. Now, what's amusing about this objection is it's sort of the opposite of another objection you'll get from the same person. So you'll often be told that, well, there's so much poverty that's caused by capitalism. You've got the rich and the poor. And then when you point out that, in fact, no, actually, the poor even in free economies tend to do much better than even the rich in poor economies, then they switch to the other side and say, well, it makes everybody so rich and there's so many choices. And we can buy everything as commodities. That it debases us. Well, I mean, which is it? Either it causes most people to be poor or it makes us so rich that we become materialists. Well, of course, what they're doing is they're looking at two different partial pictures of the system. I agree that consumerism as an ideology is bad simply because it's a form of idolatry. The idea that we should treat our material possessions, put them in a position that they ought not to hold, that we should have a loyalty to them that ought to be reserved for God. Obviously, that's a bad thing. I would just simply dispute the idea that a free economy, that is an economy that has private property rights and rule of law and economic freedom, that itself leads to consumerism or materialism. I don't know of any argument for that. I certainly don't know of any argument that it leads to kind of a debased aesthetic. I mean, all you have to do is visit, as I did in the 1980s, Eastern European countries, or have a look at North Korea, if you can, or the former Soviet Union. These were the most dedicated socialist countries, and you'll never find a more impoverished aesthetic environment. I mean, I do think what's essentially going on in a lot of these, the kind of what I'd call these aesthetic critiques of market economies, is that a lot of people, especially a lot of intellectuals, they don't like the choices of ordinary people. I mean, intellectuals like ourselves, I'm speaking about you, the two of us, Tom, we sometimes get this kind of aristocratic attitude. We're poor. We're not rich like the aristocrats, but we sort of imagine ourselves in this way. And so we disdain the ordinary choices of working class people that are perfectly happy to go to Domino's Pizza. They think that's a nice meal. And we complain about that. We complain about a lot of the junk that gets put on YouTube. We don't notice that. Look, 200 years ago, virtually no one had access to music. And so the few people that had access to wonderful music were the aristocrats who could actually gather together in an estate somewhere and listen to an orchestra play Chopin or Bach. Now it's practically free. Anybody can access music, and anybody can create music and upload it to the internet, upload it to YouTube. And so as a result, when everybody's able to do something, the sort of average thing that's produced is not going to be especially good. But my argument is, look, that's surely something to celebrate, that more people, if they want to, everyone, if they want to, as long as they have an internet connection, can listen to all the most beautiful music that's ever been written. They can see scans of the most wonderful art that's ever been made. I don't begrudge the system that allows that to be possible, even if it also allows ordinary people to produce some things that maybe those of us with refined tastes wouldn't prefer. Every kind of economic system and every change is going to come with both some costs and some benefits. I would much rather have the costs of a free society, and including its benefits, than to suffer the costs of one in which these things are excluded.
Let's do like a lightning round style now. I'll give you a topic and you take 60 seconds, let's say, to address it. So let's start with what you call the Nirvana myth. And I'll so you won't have to spend part of your 60 seconds explaining it. It's the idea, this is a fallacy that I don't know if it was Harold Demsetz, some Chicago economist has also used this to say that socialists sometimes use this fallacy. They look at capitalism, they see that it's not perfect, they then posit an ideal society that is obviously unreachable by any system, and then it's so much the worse for capitalism. So that, and you're saying that's also to be heard in Christian circles.
Absolutely. I mean, we very often, again, we focus on our aspiration. And what this does is if you focus on an unrealizable ideal rather than the live alternatives, what it does is it flattens the real options. So, of course, if you're the kingdom of God in its fullness is your ideal, and then you compare, say, 2016 in the United States with North Korea, well, the difference between North Korea and the United States in 2016 is trivial compared to the difference between the United States and the kingdom of God, where there's no want or crying or death. But we can't access the kingdom of God in that way. We aren't able to establish the kingdom of God in its fullness. And so what you want to do when you're saying, okay, of the live alternatives, things we can actually bring about by our own power, what's the best of those? When you frame the question in that way, it's obvious what the answer is, that free economies, for all their problems, for all their non-utopian qualities, are vastly superior for doing the things you'd want an economy to do than any of the alternatives that humans have ever been able to come up with. If you frame it that way, you make the argument, I think, really clear, certainly for Christians that are willing to look at the evidence.
All right, second one. Doesn't capitalism foster unfair competition? And you refer to this as myth number three, the zero-sum game. Trade requires a winner and a loser.
Yes, and this one is common because it's intuitive that if you look at, say, I go out and I'm going to buy a flat-screen TV, I want to look at Walmart and Target, and if I buy it from Target, Walmart's not going to get my business. And so you see that as a competition. And people that don't understand market economies will think that's the whole story. But what they don't notice is that free exchange, if you analyze it carefully, is actually a win-win. It's not a win-lose or zero-sum game scenario. And I tell this story of the trading game, which is a game I played in the sixth grade, in which a teacher hands out toys to everyone and then essentially allows them to freely trade amongst themselves. And she has them say how much they like the toy at the beginning they started with and then how much they like the toy that they got at the end. And they almost always like the one they got at the end better. And the reason is because she set up a system with the rule of law and then said, now all of you can freely trade. And so no one trades a toy with another person unless they want the toy the other kid has. And it's the same from the perspective of the other kid. They don't trade unless they want the toy the other kid has. And that's win-win. And what's amazing about that is that means that just a system of rule of law and free exchange by itself, even without adding anything new to the system, can actually lead to people being better off, to perceiving their situation as better than it was at the beginning. This happens every time we go to the grocery store or go to the barber. We engage in this kind of mutually beneficial exchange. But people that haven't thought about it, we're not used to actually analyzing that. So we only notice the competitive part of a free market. We don't notice the mutually beneficial exchanges that happen, as a matter of course, every single day.
And finally, I don't want to do the one on capitalism being based on greed, because I feel like I've handled that so much. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason that the idea that people should have voluntary exchanges with each other has anything to do with greed whatsoever. That these
exactly.
things have, this is just a complete red herring and a misconception. But what about the, if I become rich, won't someone else become poor? I think that speaks to the guilt manipulators aspect. That
it
actually, you know, it makes people feel like if you have a lot of dough, that's probably because you stole it from some guy in the third world or something.
That's right. And of course, I distinguish between the zero-sum game myth, which I sort of say, I use that as a, that's a view of the nature of trade. This, what I call the materialist myth, I say that's a myth about the nature of wealth. And so if you think of wealth as just a, like a pot of gold, right? So our economy is, there's this fixed amount of wealth out there. And if some people get there too soon, they get more than their fair share and they leave less for the rest of us. It's like a physical manifestation of the zero-sum game. I say, okay, well, that would make sense if the economy were like a pot of gold or like a pie. It, you know, if it's just like this pie, then the best we can do is try to slice it up equitably. But of course, that's nothing like what real healthy economies are like. Nobody thinks that Steve Jobs, the late Steve Jobs, got rich by stealing iPods and iPads from homeless people. We know that's not true. He didn't extract wealth from an economy and then just give it to somebody else. What he did is he participated in a process of wealth creation in which he created value for himself and many other people. That's what real economies do when they trade with each other, when they have the modicums of freedom and the rule of law that they need. Human beings, creatures made in the image of God, we create wealth and value that wasn't there before. And so that means Peter could get fabulously wealthy, not by defrauding or stealing someone, but by doing something that creates value for himself and for others. And that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. As long as you understand that, that the economy, wealth can be created rather than merely shifted around, that keeps you from making a lot of simple elementary mistakes you might otherwise make about economics.
All right, Jay, before I let you go, I know you have been running a website. It's not a personal site.
Mm-hmm.
It's well beyond that. There are a lot of contributors to it, and it's stream.org. Take a minute to tell us about it.
Absolutely.
Of course, I'm going to link to that, and I'm going to link to your book at tomwoods.com/831, this being episode 831. So it's been many episodes since you were on last. I'll link to that. That's the show notes page for today. All right, so tell us about the stream.
Absolutely. It's an effort that an evangelical named James Robinson and I launched about 2 years ago. And the purpose of it is to bring serious Catholics and evangelicals together to talk not just about theology and apologetics, but also to be able to talk about culture and politics and economics. Because we noticed that there are some publications and sites that do this, but we were distressed that Catholics and evangelicals tend to occupy sort of non-overlapping areas, except for a few kind of elite publications like First Things. The other thing that happens is a lot of Christian sites don't focus on the details of economics and politics. They tend to avoid that. We wanted a site in which all of that stuff could be done together, where serious Catholics and evangelicals could come together, take our theology seriously, and take seriously how it applies to the issues of the day. And so we've got a lot of great editors and contributors, including John Zmirak, who writes for us very frequently as one of our senior editors.
You know what? Shouldn't I get John on the show? Why have I not had John Zmirak on the show?
That's a good question, because, you know, you did that great book on the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, and his recent book also in that series is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism.
That's right. Yeah. I should. But I mean, I have a limited segment of the audience that's interested in the church, but I have done episodes like on the weekend as a bonus episode on that subject, and people have really eaten it up. So, but also John talks about everything under the sun. I could get him on to, we could talk about names in the phone book. If people still looked in phone books.
That's right. And he writes actually a lot on these economic issues. And so, yeah, he'd be terrific.
All right. Okay. I'm going to jot that down. Okay, yeah, I got to know him back when I lived in New York in the early 90s or mid-90s. Sure. Mid-90s. Yeah, I got pictures of I have a picture of us with some brunch friends, and we're so young looking. I don't know what John looks like now, but I know I don't look like that anymore. So anyway, yeah, I definitely got to get him on.
Absolutely. And he lived in New York at the time, and he's a native of Queens, but he actually lives down in Dallas, Texas now. So he's more surrounded by people that he agrees with.
Ah, okay. Because I know he was in New Hampshire. I can't keep track of that guy.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, he's one of our senior editors and one of our most popular writers at the Stream.
Okay. All right. Yeah, he's funny and smart. Okay. So anyway, well, look, stream.org is for interested people to check out for sure. And of course, the book we've been talking about is Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. Available on Amazon, and I'll link to it directly at tomwoods.com/831. All right, Jay, great job. Thanks for being here. Great talking to you.
Great talk to you, Tom.
Okay, everybody, before I let you go, I've got an announcement that might be of interest to some of you. You know that Gene Epstein is a relatively frequent guest on the show. He's the economics and book review editor over at Barron's. Well, he's also in charge of a relatively new debating society in New York City, the Soho Forum. And he wanted me to let you know about their next event. You should go to all of them because they're really interesting. But their next event is Monday, February 5th. I beg your pardon, Monday, February 13th, 2017. Get the details at thesohoforum.org. It takes place at 45 Bleecker Street. Doors open at 5:45 p.m. And here is the topic. Ben Powell will be defending the following proposition against Mark Krikorian. And it reads as follows. U.S. immigration policy should be to issue migration visas without any numerical limitations to all applicants who are not on a terrorist watch list and who do not otherwise have criminal records or contagious diseases. Ben Powell is the editor of The Economics of Immigration. He also directs the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University. And Mark Krikorian is the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Immigration Studies. So Monday, February 13th, get the details at thesohoforum.org. Remember, if you're enjoying the show, join the elite as a member of the Supporting Listeners program over at supportinglisteners.com. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.